Hello, and welcome to the History of the Early Church. Episode 71, The Eusebians Strike Back. When we began our narrative of the Arian controversy, I noted how there are different chronologies various scholars have put forward. Issues relating to dating documents and events for those early years can be quite challenging. Nevertheless, the essential sequence of what happened and why is still fairly straightforward. Arius and Alexander disagreed on the relationship of the son to the father. After the Arians were kicked out of Alexandria, they gained allies abroad, prompting Alexander to do the same. The two factions battled it out in letters and competing councils. The conflict was temporarily halted by the persecution of Licinius, but once Constantine conquered the east, infighting resumed. The emperor decided to settle the matter once and for all by summoning the Council of Nicaea. At the Great Ecumenical Synod, Arius and his supporters were defeated, and the Nicene Creed was produced, thus bringing an end to the first phase of the controversy. To many Christians at the time, it probably seemed the issue was over, but of course, we know just how incredibly wrong they were. Today we enter phase two of the Arian controversy. This phase will consist of the roughly two decades elapsing from the aftermath of Nicaea to the late 340s, when conflict temporarily petered out. However, the chronological problems we run into for the first few years after Nicaea are far worse than those which we encountered beforehand. When tracing the story from Arius to Nicaea, we know basically what happened and why, even if we don't have all the details pinned down. By contrast, the few years immediately after Nicaea are a confused mess, with our sources giving us contradictory information and inconsistent dates. What follows, then, is a best effort reconstruction based on recent scholarship. Most especially, Sarah Parvis's monograph, Marcellus of Ancyra and the Lost Years of the Arian Controversy, has been tremendously helpful in researching this period. The Council of Nicaea did not bring an end to the theological debate. Theologians on both sides of the divide continued to debate the central issues raised by the conflict over Arius. The broad division between theologians over the Trinity was still there, those who emphasized the similarities within the Godhead, and those who emphasized the differences. In the years leading up to Nicaea, these sides were represented by the pro-Alexander and pro-Arian alliances, respectively. Though Arius was at the center of the debate, the real political power of the alliance which backed him came from Eusebius of Nicomedia and his allies. The small but tight-knit and politically active coalition of bishops led by Eusebius are conventionally dubbed the Eusebians. The Eusebians came mainly from Bithynia, Cilicia, and the Levant. Though all of these bishops were different in many ways theologically, they all shared a common emphasis on the distinctions within the Trinity, and thus regarded Sabellianism as the most threatening of heresies. Though Eusebius of Nicomedia himself and Theognis of Nicaea were deposed and banished, their coalition did not dissolve. After Nicaea, we see again and again these same bishops showing up at different church councils and working together in concert. The church historian Eusebius of Caesarea was, as we've seen, a card-carrying member of the Eusebian coalition, as were his friends Paulinus of Tyre and Theodotus of Laodicea. It's important that we differentiate the Eusebians from the Arians. Often these two groups are discussed interchangeably. Though the Eusebians were pro-Arian and repeatedly supported Arius, they should be distinguished from the Arians proper. Again, when I refer to the Arians in this podcast, I'm referring to Arius himself and his immediate followers from Alexandria and Libya. people like the Alexandrian deacon Eusoius, and the two Libyan bishops exiled at the Council of Nicaea, Secundus of Ptolemais and Theonas of Marmarica. Of course, the opponents of the Eusebians did eventually start derisively calling them Arians, and this usage has influenced modern accounts of the period. However, in order to accurately understand this history, it's important we separate the two groups. The Eusebians are, in many ways, far more important to the longer history of the controversy than Arius and his circle of followers. I should note as well that, like the Arians, the Eusebians never referred to themselves as such. The term was one concocted by their opponents. However, it is still a useful descriptor for our purposes, and I will continue to use it so long as it's relevant. So in short, the Eusebians are the coalition of bishops who share an emphasis on the differences within the Godhead and therefore support Arius politically, whereas the Arians are Arius himself and his direct disciples. In the period immediately following Nicaea, Eusebian theologians continued to debate and conflict with members of the old pro-Alexander alliance in what amounted to a theological pamphlet war. This war centered around the term homoousios in the Nicene Creed. The chief agitators in the conflict were Eusebius of Caesarea and the fiercely anti-Arian Eustathius of Antioch. Eustathius of Antioch was a passionate man and had no problem ratcheting the tone of the debate up to 11. He denounced his opponents as Ariomaniacs, a pun on Arius's name, which resembled the name of the Greek god of war, Ares. Ariomaniacs meant in Greek those who stir up war for Ares / Arius. He accused Eusebius of Caesarea of turning his back on the Nicene Creed, which they had all signed, and even went so far as to outright accuse the Palestinian of straight-up polytheism for questioning homoousios. Eusebius, for his part, asserted he was not reneging on the Nicene Creed, and responded in kind to Eustathius's polytheism accusation by denouncing the Bishop of Antioch as a Sabellian. The two sides were talking past one another, and accomplishing little in the process. Unfortunately, this pamphlet war proved to be some of the last serious theological discussion of homoousios and the Nicene Creed for many years. In addition to his pamphlet war with Eusebius, Eustathius also, in his capacity as metropolitan, excluded from the Syrian clergy any men he found to be unacceptable, including those whom he dubbed Ariomaniacs. Eustathius had a large and popular loyal following among the clergy and laity of the city. But his rhetoric and actions did nothing to heal the rift within the Antiochian church. What rift was that, you say? You'll recall that after the death of Philogonius of Antioch back in December 324, Osius of Cordova convened a synod which translated Eustathius from Berea to the metropolitan see of Syria. However, the Eusebian pro-Arian faction of Syria had supported translating Paulinus of Tyre, and it seems that strife had continued between the two camps in the following years. Though Eustathius was the officially recognized bishop, there was a sizable faction who backed Paulinus. Supporting Paulinus's claims, of course, were his fellow Eusebian bishops of the region. Among the most ardent were his close friends, who had been humiliated with a provisional excommunication by the same council which had handed Eustathius the bishopric: Theodotus of Laodicea and Eusebius of Caesarea. To add further insult to injury, Eusebius had now been publicly accused of hypocrisy and polytheism. Theodotus, meanwhile, had made enough of a stir after Nicaea to merit a sharply worded letter from the emperor himself. Constantine reminded him of how the now banished Eusebius of Nicomedia and Theognis did not correct themselves after Nicaea, something the emperor felt Theodotus should keep in mind. Tensions were high across Syria, and the Christians of Antioch were just waiting for the other shoe to drop. Into this wonderful situation walked the emperor's mother, Helena. Fresh off her legendary pilgrimage in Palestine, the Augusta and her entourage arrived in the Syrian capital in the autumn of 327. Such an imperial visit was a major affair, and all the leading citizens of the city attended the ceremonies, including Eustathius and perhaps even Paulinus. It seems it was within this context that an altercation of some sort occurred between the empress and Eustathius. As bizarre as it may seem that Eustathius actually insulted the emperor's mother, the conflict with Paulinus provides a plausible scenario. It's quite possible Helena conferred upon Paulinus some kind of unofficial recognition or approval, which the passionate Eustathius took great offense at. But why would the empress express favor toward Paulinus? Well, because Helena had pro-Arian sympathies. For example, last episode we saw how devoted she was to the martyr Lucian of Antioch, the teacher of many of the Eusebians and Arians. Nor was Helena alone among the women of the imperial household in this regard, as Constantia was quite close to Eusebius of Nicomedia. Helena left Antioch later that autumn, but by around October, the biannual Provincial Council of Syria was meeting. It was here that the Eusebians of the Levant, led by Eusebius of Caesarea, pounced. In addition to the charge of insulting the empress, Eustathius was also accused of Sabellianism, not surprising given the pamphlet war, and fornication. Supposedly, the Eusebians produced a woman of ill repute who claimed Eustathius was the father of her illegitimate child. Eustathius was convicted, deposed, and imperial troops escorted him to exile in Illyricum. The disgraced bishop was joined in exile by some of his loyal clergy, who the Eusebians would go on to replace with men amenable to their faction. Finally, the Eusebians were able to officially install Paulinus to the See of Antioch. This was technically a violation of Canon 15 of the Council of Nicaea, but from the perspective of the Eusebians, Paulinus had been the true bishop of Antioch since 324. It seems some of his supporters even backdated his reign to reflect this. Now in control of the metropolitanate of Syria, the Eusebians had laid the groundwork to shift the rest of the Levant to their favor. If the Eusebians thought their ecclesiastical coup would go down quietly, they gravely miscalculated. Already simmering with tension, it seems the Christian populace exploded into full-scale rioting. The violence became so bad that imperial troops had to be called in. The Eusebians sought the aid of the emperor, who sent court officials as representatives with letters where Constantine admonished the Christians of the city to cease their rebellious behavior and remember their Christian identity. The local supporters of Eustathius would never forget their beloved bishop, and went on to form their own separatist faction in Antioch, known appropriately as the Eustathians. Despite imperial efforts to end the strife, the Eustathians never gave up their cause, and we will see them pop up periodically throughout the narrative. The emperor's involvement leads us to the biggest quandary of today's episode. Because it was right around the same time that Eustathius was deposed that Constantine decided to recall Arius himself from exile. Constantine clearly supported the Council of Antioch's deposition of Eustathius, as he enforced the exile and did not dispute its verdict, even in the face of the Eustathians' staunch resistance. The emperor may even have personally interviewed Eustathius before banishing him. So, what changed, and when? How did Constantine go from exiling Arius to now recalling him, and instead exiling a fierce anti-Arian? And perhaps, most importantly, who was influencing the emperor to make such an about-face? To take the last question first, the obvious ecclesiastical figure to point to would be the arch-Machiavellian Eusebius of Nicomedia. Indeed, this appears to be what later generations believed, even asserting Eusebius of Nicomedia was present at the council which deposed Eustathius. But of course, the problem with that is, at this point, Eusebius is still in exile on the other side of the empire in Gaul with his friend Theognis. Even though the later 5th century church historians state the bishop of Nicomedia returned from exile before Eustathius was deposed, modern scholars working from contemporary documents have largely concluded this is incorrect, and the order of these events should be reversed. But yeah, by the way, just so you know, Eusebius of Nicomedia and Theognis are about to be restored to their sees, but we're getting ahead of ourselves. The upshot is that it wasn't Eusebius of Nicomedia pulling the strings this time around. But of course, Eusebius still had friends in high places. Whether it be his relative, Julius Julianus, or pro-Arian courtiers, or even the Empress Constantia. The later church historians record a story of how, on her deathbed, Constantia recommended to her brother a presbyter who was in her confidence. According to the story, this presbyter was pro-Arian and had been tasked by Eusebius of Nicomedia with gaining Constantia's confidence and convincing her that Arius had been wrongfully condemned at Nicaea. After Constantia's death, the presbyter then prevailed upon the emperor to recall Arius. Scholars put little stock in this story, but it may preserve an element of truth, that members of the imperial household, perhaps those attached to Constantia, were sympathetic to Arius, and were responsible for changing the emperor's mind. For my part, I wonder if perhaps this story originally had Helena as the empress. Perhaps upon her return to Constantine after being insulted by Eustathius at Antioch, she provided the crucial influence. Though not literally on her deathbed by that point, Helena did die later the following year. Perhaps, given Helena's later status as a saint and discoverer of the true cross, subsequent church historians changed the name of the empress, or assumed it was Constantia, when writing down the story. But I'm just speculating at this point. We'll likely never know for sure the names of those who influenced the emperor to change his position. So what happened first? Did Constantine change his mind about Arius before Eustathius was deposed, and thus Eustathius's fall was a consequence of this change? Or did Eustathius's fall happen first and serve as a trigger for Constantine's about-face? Modern historians have answered this question differently. For instance, Sarah Parvis argues that Eusebian courtiers presented Constantine with putative proof that Eustathius had impregnated a low-born woman. Shocked at such sexual sin within the clergy, the emperor cooperated with the Eusebians to ensure Eustathius was deposed and exiled with absolute discretion, so as not to tarnish the image of the church and harm the faith of the people. Meanwhile, the scandal had shaken Constantine's confidence in the Council of Nicaea's condemnation of Arius, causing the emperor to dismiss Osius of Cordova and recall Arius from exile. In contrast, Sophie Cartwright, in her book The Theological Anthropology of Eustathius of Antioch, argues for an alternative sequence of events. In her reconstruction, it was Eustathius's fall after insulting Helena, and Helena's own influence upon her return from Antioch, which triggered Constantine's change of mind and the recall of Arius. So, which is it? Did Constantine recall Arius before or after he learned of Eustathius's fall? Just like the question of who influenced the emperor, we'll probably never know for sure. It doesn't matter now, though. However it happened, Eustathius is gone, Arius is on his way back, and everyone else is just going to have to deal with it. Arius seems to have been reluctant to believe that the emperor was really granting him clemency, as he did not immediately make with all haste to Nicomedia. So, on November 27th, the emperor sent him another letter, asking Arius why he had delayed the invitation to come to court and be reconciled. Arius complied with this second summons, and, along with his follower and fellow exile Eusoius, who had also been allowed to return by the emperor, made his way east. Arius and Eusoius then submitted a formal letter to Constantine containing a personal statement of faith, as requested. This personal creed obviously did not include either homoousios or ectes ousios. In fact, it was a fairly generic creed which virtually any Christian could accept. Arius and Eusoius shrewdly concluded their letter by appealing to the emperor in two ways. First, they expressed their desire for peace within the church, and second, they prayed for the prosperous rule of the Constantinian dynasty. Constantine found their letter acceptable and put it before the Autumn Synod of Bithynia, which met in his presence at Nicomedia toward the end of 327. There, per the emperor's conditions, Arius and Eusoius were required to acknowledge, or at least pay lip service to, the Nicene Creed, which they did. The synod then formally readmitted them into communion. When word of Arius's return reached the exiled Eusebius and Theognis over in Gaul, they submitted their own letter to the Synod of Bithynia. In their letter, they reminded the synod that they were, after all, only in exile because they had refused to sign the anathemas against Arius, not because they objected to homoousios in the Nicene Creed. Of course, Eusebius conveniently ignored his acceptance into communion of Arians from Alexandria shortly after the Great Council. They were not heretics, the two asserted. They simply felt Arius had been wrongfully condemned. Now that Arius had been rehabilitated, they asked that the next provincial council, during the following Lent, restore them to their sees so the emperor would recall them from exile. The Bithynian synod agreed and formally pronounced Eusebius and Theognis restored the following March in the presence of the emperor. After which, the pair made the journey back home, and by the summer, they had reoccupied their churches. Around the same time the Bithynians were having their Lenten council, the Syrians were doing the same. I'm not a superstitious man, but I would not be at all surprised if we one day found out that, on his way into exile, Eustathius prayed to God to put a curse on the bishopric of Antioch. For the next few years after his fall, no man could occupy the Antiochian see without keeling over dead in a number of months. By March or April 328, Paulinus of Tyre was dead, and the Syrians needed to elect a new metropolitan. The Eusebians were still in control, and so they installed the Cappadocian presbyter Eulalius, Once again, the Eustathians didn't take this lying down, and rioting resumed in the city, prompting the imperial authorities to once again intervene. So there you have it. Here we are, only 3 years removed from the Council of Nicaea, and the Eusebian faction has managed to claim the bishopric of Antioch and restore Arius and Eusebius of Nicomedia. Watching all this unfold with great alarm was Alexander of Alexandria. The elderly Coptic Pope had been helpless to watch as almost all his alliance's achievements at Nicaea were undone. The worst part of it all, though, was the return of Arius. When Arius was formally readmitted into communion at Nicomedia, the emperor asked that Alexander receive him back as a presbyter. The bishop of Alexandria was mortified at such a prospect. Arius could fool everybody else, but as far as Alexander was concerned, his former presbyter was still a dangerous heretic whose newfound acceptance of the Nicene Creed was transparently insincere. However, Alexander was now in a difficult position. It was one thing for a synod of another province to restore Arius. It was quite another for the emperor of the Roman Empire to ask that he accept such a decision. Alexander demurred and ignored the initial request. So when the Lenten Synod of Bithynia restored Eusebius and Theognis, the emperor once again insisted that Alexander make peace with Arius and restore him to the local presbytery. Alexander's health was already in decline, and so he was unable to travel to Nicomedia himself. He therefore sent his trusted deacon, Athanasius, to represent him before the emperor and plead his case that Arius must not be restored in Alexandria. It was while Athanasius was away at the imperial court that on April 17th, 328, just 3 days after Easter, Alexander died. We don't know how old the bishop was when he died, but Alexander had led the Church of Egypt for some 15 critical years. Next episode, we properly introduce Alexander's successor, the man who will be at the center of virtually everything in our narrative for the next half century, the man who is arguably the most important church father of the entire 4th century, Alexander's faithful deacon, Athanasius, known to history as Athanasius the Great. Athanasius is himself a huge subject, justifiably so. Thus, I'm going to need a few extra weeks in order to properly tackle the next batch of episodes. I won't be gone for too long, and we'll be back soon as we cover the complicated and turbulent series of events that make up Athanasius's early years on the throne of St. Mark.